Conversations with the biggest names in rock music and pop culture. You're listening to Spin Magazine's Lip Service with Scott Lips.
Welcome back to Spin Magazine's Lip Service. I'm your host, Scott Lips. We did an extensive interview with the legendary Ian Asbury of The Cult a few months ago. Now on the heels of their death cult shows in the States, he's back to talk further about it and the cult shows. Welcome the great Ian Asbury of The Cult.
You're listening to Spin Magazine's Lip Service.
Welcome, my friend, the legendary Ian Asbury. How are you?
I am tripping, bro. It's like... Monday morning, we're leaving on Wednesday, got rehearsal today, dojo. It's like full on. It's always like this. Nothing for months, and then everything gets done in the last minute. So, yay!
Well, we're here. I'm excited to get into the tour. I'm excited to get into the Death Cult show October 12th at the Gramercy. Excited to be working on it with you. This is like a dream come true. It's amazing.
It's about time, Scott.
It's about time.
It's about time.
It's true. It's true. We've been friends for so many years.
I like that we're doing this rogue. This is like totally rogue, spontaneous, organic.
Yeah, it's been so fun watching the process of putting the show together. You know, if someone's coming to a death cult show, because a lot of people ask me, what can they expect to see, Ian?
What can they expect to see?
Besides the obvious. Well, because you play, you know, it's some of the early songs, but also Sanctuary and Rain and Hollow Man,
no,
right?
We might not play any of that. We're in rehearsals right now. We're thinking, maybe we're not going to play those songs. Maybe we'll play them, maybe we won't play them. Because the Beacon is the death cult and the cult. Death cult, you'll witness a burning unicorn. How about that?
That's all I can say.
Look, with all respect, there's not much going on out there in terms of performers, bands who really are coming from source, from the heart, with intention. There's so much fluffy entertainment going on. We don't do that. It's raw, it's in the moment. We have the provenance. We have the experience. I feel a bit like Liam Gallagher trenching. You know, Liam's great. I wish I had Liam Gallagher to say something quite witty.
Ian, I was saying, if someone comes to a death cult show, what should they expect? Some of the old stuff, some of the early stuff, 83?
Old stuff.
The stuff from 83. We're not necessarily going to hear She Sells Sanctuary, Hollow Man, Rain.
Oh, well, you may hear one of those three songs.
Or we may not.
But you're definitely going to hear God Zoo. You're definitely going to hear Spirit Walker. You're definitely going to hear Resurrection Joe. You're definitely going to hear songs from the first EP. Death Cult is as much about, this isn't an archaeological dig. This isn't the Smithsonian. You know, we're not trying to recreate 1983, 84. It's impossible. These songs, it's one of the weird things with music, the strange aspects of music. It's played in the moment. So even though you may have some abstract idea about time, it's what happens in the moment. So from that point of view, it's about the visceral experience of what we're going to do. And how we curate the set. Because we curate the set in a way that is kind of alchemical. So it has a certain arc to it. And we consider this. We consider what grabs us emotionally, what is exciting to perform in that moment. And we're way under rehearsed, which is good, because that's what death cult should be. Is raw, visceral, in the moment. And as I've said several times, it's an opportunity to witness a burning unicorn. And that's one of the only ways I can really describe death cult, because when I look around, I don't see too many artists doing what we do. Maybe in hip-hop communities, a lot of artists that are quite, they have that edge, they have that real connection to the environments that they came from, as do we. And that's never stopped since day one. You know, we're fully in this. I mean, today, my whole day is about getting ready for these shows. It's training. I've been training for months, dojo. Staying grounded. There's been a lot going on behind the scenes because we put the whole thing together, production, merch, working with labels. We've got some releases coming out this year. We've got two albums that are being repressed. Choice of Weapon and Hidden City, they're being repressed because they're out, vinyl sold out, so we're repressing those. We're looking at potentially something for Death Cult later in the year, so more should be revealed.
Take me back to 1983, because the band only played a handful of shows back then, right? So to revisit this music lyrically, what's it like for you?
Well, again, you know, Death Cult was a transitional period from Sudden Death Cult to the Cult. But within those 8 or 9 months, we were working it out and we were moving at an incredible pace. Within 6 weeks, we put a band together. We had some songs and we went out and played. Probably within, we got together right late March, maybe early April, 83. By June, July, we were out playing shows. And the first show we did was in Oslo. So we went to like Oslo, Berlin, Amsterdam, and Paris.
Amazing.
With this kind of, I mean, pretty much punk band, like totally raw, under-rehearsed, super spontaneous. You know, so from that point of view, that's what I've kept Death Cult fresh. We cryogenically it was frozen, and now it's been reanimated. And playing these songs is so invigorating. I mean, it's the DNA of who we are. So it's our DNA. Like as Picasso said, he said, I'll always steal for myself. Mm. If he sees an old sketch or something, he said, you know, I will always steal for myself. I feel the same way with Death Cult. We're kind of stealing from ourselves, which is kind of strange, again. But it's our DNA. And playing raw live music is a forgotten art form.
You and I talk a lot about dark wave because it's something that obviously you're very vested in. Early on when you were working on this music, obviously there were bands like Bauhaus and bands like that were obviously deep into it too. But did you feel like you were on the forefront of a music that's still so relevant today? You and I, again, discuss bands like, you know, Rami and all these other artists that are really happening now in dark wave and goth, right? But did you feel at the time like you were part of a scene that was just bubbling, that you were sort of reinventing what music was at the time?
No, we were just so focused on, we were in the audience, then we're in a band, then we're on a stage, but we're still with the audience. It was a tribe. And that tribe has been in and out of fashion, in and out of Vogue, in and out of, but people have always kind of gone back to that period to extract aesthetic, mostly aesthetic inspiration. But there's no way that you can recreate that environment. It's impossible. What was going on in London? We were in Brixton. So what was going on at that time, 82, 83, 84, socio-politically dystopian, you know, dystopian uncertainty. It was a zeitgeist. And I really feel that when we talk about the dark wave, we're talking about shadow. And if we know anything, anybody out there who's a budding, you know, nascent psychologist, Carl Jung refers to the shadow. The shadow is always with us. It's our subconscious, it's our unconscious. And that's an archetypal, it's an archetype. And we delve into that, but that's the space that we go into. We're really good in that space. We're not sun followers. We don't follow fame, success, fortune, trophies, accolades. That's never been in our DNA. We've never done that. Yes, we've played MTV Awards. Yes, we've done these events, but they were of the time and of the moment. I really didn't care whether I got an award or not. It didn't interest me. It's amazing how many people stack Grammys and go, now it's Grammy nominated. But what really, who's the institution that's voting for you? If it was your peers, amazing. If it was the audience, incredible. But when it's a body of unseen, veiled individuals, I don't know what the actual provenance or the value is of that award, other than getting dressed up and going out and having a great night out. So we left that whole system. We came up, we bumped up against it. And as soon as we kind of got in the room, we were just didn't feel it. Didn't feel real, didn't feel authentic. We don't go to parties, those kind of parties. We do go to parties, but not parties where you celebrate yourself, you know, or the industry or whatever. We've never been interested in that.
Well, it's always been about the art form for you, even more so now, maybe now than ever. Like, you're so vested in everything from the creative direction, the graphics. It's all about the credibility and the art form for you. And it's always been about that, nothing else. Right. So even more so now, when you see where music has gone, I think these shows mean more to you now than anything.
You know, it's a really interesting. Thank you for saying that. I mean, that's, it is what it is. You know, things inspire me. They go through a process, they go through a filter. It reveals itself in a piece of clothing, piece of film, piece of music, whatever I'm working on creatively. I just saw today that Spotify dropped 75 million cut tracks of spam tracks.
Oh my God.
75 million spam tracks.
Are these AI tracks or what are they? They're just...
They're kind of like just, you've got these guys, like, you know, some composer in Sweden who's got about like 200 accounts. So if you want music for your dog to sleep by, you know, it's just, and they've got all these accounts running. And then you've got dudes who are like, worked it out. They've got streaming farms where they just got like, you know, 1,000 cell phones or whatever, or and computers and bots just amping these tracks in terms of likes and plays, and they're getting the money. And it, the model is, it's already been hacked. So real authentic music, like real numbers, the cult has real numbers. We don't have bots. We don't have, you know, numbers that have been finagled with. But this isn't the fashion industry.
That's true. It's very much true.
You know, what we do is from source. It's authentic. Get us on a good night, we destroy. Get us on a bad night, still not, it still cuts. But it's real. I mean, that's the way I run it. That's how we run that stage. It's not. And it's integration without audience, without participation, without community. It doesn't come off. I mean, our audience, people who come and buy a ticket, they're our benefactors. Like, we're completely not going to turn up and give them, you know, what I had for breakfast. No, they're going to get, we'll have to get to a special place to let these songs be their ultimate version of themselves. And that's us being connected. We're not really in the head game while we're playing. It's all gut. It's all instinct. Things happen in the moment. What happens in the moment stays in the moment. They walk off stage, people will say to me, did you enjoy it? Was it fun? I go, it happened. Right. We're so in it. You're so in it.
We mentioned Visceral, you know, last time we spoke.
Yeah. It's that kind of existential, you know, objectification of a material experience or a feeling. It doesn't work like that for us. It's completely essential. It's raw. It's erotic. It mystifies me. I don't understand. I don't want to understand quantumness of music. It's vibration. Yeah, is that esoteric? Sure. But look at our body of work. I mean, people who have been to our shows know how what a cult show is. We're the contradiction in the room many, many times. We're always a contradiction. And that's not by some kind of obtuse intent. We don't intend to be difficult or obtuse or clever. It's just what is and what ain't. Mm-hmm. How about that? Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about those early days meeting Billy after Southern Death Cult disbanded. And you meet Billy, you get in the room. Was it immediate, the chemistry you had working on these songs with Death Cult?
We had to work on our relationship. I'd met Billy when he was in Theatre of Hate, when Southern Death Cult were playing with Theatre of Hate. And I really liked him. I thought he was cool. I mean, he lived in London. He had a car. He, you know, he had a little bit of money in his pocket. I mean, we're talking not much, but, you know, we had nothing. We had pennies and change. And he was cool, and he knew London. I thought, and he could play. So that was exciting to be around a real musician. And he just worked with Morrissey, et cetera. And, but here he is in London. He knew clothes. He knew clubs. He knew London really well. So I really wanted to get out of the north of England. Sudden Death Cult had imploded. And I thought Billy was really cool. Let's get together. But then you got to work out whether you can work together, write songs together. So I had some, I had a few, you know, melodies, bass lines, lyrics, some chord structures. Billy had some bits and pieces as well. And it just naturally, organically happened. I slept on his couch.
Amazing.
I went to Brixton and slept on his couch. Everything I owned was in a plastic bag. I just turned down a record deal with CBS Records for £100,000. They thought we were going to be the new Sex Pistols. Mm. I didn't want to be the new Sex Pistols. I wanted to do music. You know? The money wasn't, there was no money. Mm. It didn't matter.
Were there psychedelics involved in writing some of those early tracks? I feel like possibly, right?
I grew up in North America in the 70s. Of course, it was probably, yeah.
Do you remember what those were, or just what was going on in your head lyrically when you started writing those early songs?
I was writing what I was what I was seeing and experiencing. Plus, you know, I was a young, earnest person reading poetry and attempting to write poetry, attempting to study. You know, no one here gets how alive was the Bible. Mm. So through the lens of people like Patti Smith, Lou Reed, David Bowie, Jim Morrison, Iggy Pop, we were interested in what they were reading, what they were reading, what films they were watching. So we were picking up information. A lot of information came from Bowie because he was just, by that point, was, I mean, he was our internet. So it's like, oh, David's reading this. David's doing this. And plus, when you were out in the city in London, there were so many resources. The bookshops, record shops, clubs, gigs. I mean, we would be out 7 nights a week, going to shows, hanging out, going in bars, dressing, you know, getting trashed, getting wrecked, going in a rehearsal room, sitting down with guitars in their flat in Brixton. Or, you know, when we hit Oslo, and I'd never been to Europe before, that was mind-blowing to be so young and to have this incredible experience playing Berlin when the wall was still up.
Incredible.
At the, you know, at Monica Dorning's loft. And there's so much dope stuff happening in Berlin. And Amsterdam, Paradiso, these incredible venues. La Bande Ouche in Paris, mm-hmm. Where Joy Division had played. These are legendary venues. And there was still that kind of frequency and energy in the room. In these rooms, they still had that mystique, that aura. And even some Death Cult, we rehearsed in a spot where Joy Division used to rehearse, in the room where they shot Love Will Tear Us Apart. So all that was kind of in floating around in the ether, and we were just picking up on it. But at the time, it just was what was. It wasn't that we had this kind of now, you know, revisionist view of what it could have been like or perception of what it may have been like. It's what was happening in the moment, and we were immersed in it.
Visually, were you looking at bands like Susie and the Banshees and Bauhaus and thinking, this is something we're into?
Not as much as you would think. Because again, they were looking at Bowie.
Right.
So you couldn't move without Bowie being in the conversation.
Safe to say, without a Bowie, there might not be a Cult.
Well, there might not be anything.
Right. All roads lead to Bowie. Yeah.
with all respect, there might not be very much. Mm. So, because he truly was following the zeitgeist. I mean, his level of his Sapio computer, his ability to pick up on data and process it and make it happen and surround himself with the right people, whether it was Mick Ronson or working with Lou Reed or Iggy Pop or Brian Eno or, I mean, the bands he put together. I worked with like drummers like Dennis Thompson. I mean, the guy was a sponge. And he was blazing a trail post late 60s, early 70s. Also interesting, like hard rock. I mean, you know, Led Zeppelin had been pretty much canceled by punk rock and Pink Floyd and things like Can. Can was always cool. Can was okay with punks. You know, a lot of their breakbeats and the motoric beat, there's a special name for it in German, auf Deutsch. There was a lot of rad stuff coming out, like krautrock, and, you know, we were picking up on bits of that. We used to go to a psychedelic club in London called Alice in Wonderland. But at the bar in Alice in Wonderland, you would see Nick Cave, a Blitzer Bargeld, Jeffrey Lee Pierce from the Gun Club, you know, Susie, the guys from The Cure. I mean, you see everybody in this bar. The place only held 150 people.
Amazing.
At midnight, they locked the door. And the DJ was playing everything like garage punk from, you know, things like the Standells or 13th Floor Elevators and the psych rock, even like Dark Side Floyd when Sid was in the band and playing things like Lucifer Sam, Hendrix, like obscure psychedelic tracks, Velvet Underground, Nico. I mean, we were able to see people like Nico perform.
Incredible.
We were able to see Johnny Thunders. We were able to see Bowie. We were able to see Iggy. One of the first gigs Billy and I went to was Iggy Pop at the venue in, I don't know, it was like early 80s. You know, Johnny Thunders. And they walked the earth. They were still very young and they were still at the height of their powers. And it was accessible. Plus, we were able to access... I remember meeting Mick Jagger at like a Killing Joke show. Oh no, Spirit of Destiny maybe. Like Jagger would come down with his publicist. You know, I was hanging out. Jimmy Page was at, I think Jimmy Page was at Killing Joke show. So it was this kind of incredible crossover between 60s, 70s and the aughts, the early 80s. And there was this incredible transference of energy and influence. And we were right there picking up on every single molecule that we could get. We'd go out and study everything, ask so many questions. You know, we were incredibly naive. So we just asked questions that may have been very simplistic. And then you had the music publications like The Enemy, Sounds, Melody Maker. You know, you had things like Pirate Radio. There was so much information and it was raw, it was accessible. They weren't like we have now with, you know, 20 million data points. And what filter do you use on Instagram to make yourself look 20 years younger?
Right.
There was none of that shit.
Yeah.
It was didn't. So, but that continued. That was our playground. It's what we evolved from, stayed in our DNA, and we always had it. And every time we got offered a major situation, you know, by an A&R person or a media person, they would say something like, if you guys just kiss the ring, you can have the kingdom. And what that really meant was they own you and it's a lot of money. And a lot of artists took it. They took the bait. We didn't. We chose the hard way.
Well, you mentioned the record deal you turned down from Sony back in the day.
Well, that was, you know, that was a deal from Epic, I think. Was it Epic? Because I don't know if Sony existed then.
Or Epic. I mean, just the fact that they offered you this massive deal, right?
For Sudden Death Calm.
Yeah. And you just thought, no way we're going to sign this. They're going to own us for life.
I saw us being corralled into a career path. And we weren't able to... I just saw us being exploited for being young and having an edge. And then probably discarded. So many artists that were discarded or overlooked for so long, and that didn't appeal to me. It was there was already enough information that we knew that was that it wasn't. It was a wolf in sheep's clothing who was offering you the deal. And it came with terms and conditions that you would never. I mean, we signed deals in perpetuity as kids that we wish we never signed.
Right.
And we're only now resolving some of those situations decades in. So everybody assumes the cult that we've, you know, done very well financially, materially. I don't know where the money went. I didn't keep it. Maybe that's one way to stay driven.
It's never been just about that for you anyway, though, to be fair.
No, money's energy. It's you get paid your value. Who sets the values? I don't know. The person behind the curtain.
Right.
It's like fashion. This is so amazing. It is beautiful. It is everything. It is changing the face of Western civilization. No, it's not. It's clothes.
Right. You're selling a t-shirt.
The people wearing it and how they wear it and where they go and the music that they use. Imagine fashion without music. Imagine a world without music, like real music.
Yeah.
Like real intimate gatherings, people coming together. Is it like this one-off that we're going to do, the Gramercy with you, Death Cult? It's going to be lit. I mean, we're coming in raw. We're coming in hot. You know, it's not. We took 3 months to have some rest and refit because we just did 75 shows. I had torn cartilage in my right knee, so I needed a little bit of time to heal. I mean, got torn everything, rotator cuffs, hips. You know, I put symbols through my face. All of this. We're like athletes, so you need time to rest and repair. Feeling pretty good now. I've been training. Because even though we're doing this run's going to be like 15 shows, it's going to be a hard run. We're not on private jets. We're not in, you know, tier one. We do what we got to do to do what we want to do.
You mentioned you've been rehearsing. So what exactly are you rehearsing? If we could give a little bit of insight into the people that are listening to us that might be coming to the shows.
We're rehearsing in a dirty rehearsal room in the middle of the valley.
But I want to know what you're rehearsing. That's really what I want. That's the
what?
Yeah. Like which songs?
Well, it's not so much rehearsing. It's just seeing whether does the gear work?
Right.
And you look at each other in the eyes and the four of us just look at each other and then the animal appears. You have to kind of inspect the cage.
Mm.
You know, if you're in an MMA fight, you're going to want to walk in when it's quiet, touch the canvas, check the cage, eyeball your team. It's really about eyeballing everybody.
Yeah.
You check your gear, you're good to go. The songs is really a formality. I mean, we're just playing through these things maybe one or two times. If there's anything that's wonky or slightly out of sync, we'll address it. But for the most part, it's really instinctive. And we're not going to get into production until we get to, we're doing a gig in Niagara Falls before we get to Boston, before we hit New York. And I'm going to hit there, probably get there at midnight and go straight to production. Because then we got to look at the actual production for the tour, and which we've been discussing for the last 3-4 months, but then I physically considered production, and we'll make some adjustments there.
I was going to say, do you see a world when you get together with Billy in a room of writing new Death Cult songs or even new cult songs?
Well, you know, it was interesting yesterday. He started playing this guitar figure, and it sounded really dope. And Charlie joined in. And then John joined in, and then I joined in. And all of a sudden, something happened. There was a spark. So that's how it's going to happen organically. When we're in a room in a sound check, if you set up like a formal writing session, you spend so much time looking at the wall, looking at a book, looking at your phone, whatever it is you're doing, and then you're waiting for inspiration to hit you. Whereas you can be in a sound check and somebody's just farting around on the bass or whatever, and you go, that's really cool. Pocket that. I always tell people to pocket stuff. And then maybe a couple days later, go, that thing you played the other day, bring it out. Let's hear it. And then John will hear it, or Billy will hear it, or whomever's the first person to, you know, throw an idea out and then jump on it. So it usually happens organically. I find that's the best way to write songs, is you just let it happen. And if you set it up formally, it becomes a thing. There's a certain constriction because you're there to write a song. And where if you're loose and it happens spontaneously, especially when we're rehearsing these songs, it just kind of popped out and it seemed to fit with what we were doing. Because the cult's in this Renaissance hybrid moment where we're checking everything and going, that's great. We're going to focus on that. You know, and now we're beginning to appraise our last 3, 4, 5 albums, 6 albums, and look at them and go, oh, that's really, we were really trying to go for something in these records. It's worth revisiting. Which isn't to say that we're going to go out and play a lot of songs from the last 3, 4, 5 albums. We're going to hit maybe something from Beyond Good and Evil and perhaps Choice of Weapon, but the majority of the set is going to be iconic cult songs, for want of a better word, that people know.
So October 12th, Gramercy Theater, October 14th, The Beacon, and a whole bunch of other shows that everybody should be going to. My last question to you, my friend, you're always searching for the truth. Have you found it yet?
Oh, the truth. Oh, that's subjective. Yeah, you know, you think it's the truth and then it hurts and go, that's not the truth. That hurt. But maybe there is truth in getting hurt occasionally. The truth. That's a big question, Scott.
It is. I'm a deep thinker. Not like you, but I'm a deep thinker.
No, I'm a complete idiot. Well, I am. I mean, you know, idiot savant. Just, I love Iggy for that. Mm-hmm. He, you know, people get the impression he's just like raw power, Iggy Pop, you know, just raw energy. But that guy is so incredibly well-read. He is astute, incredibly well-read, articulate. I mean, what a gift that we still have him in the world.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more.
Still schooling anybody who's got a bad word to say about that man, let's have a chat.
They got no clue.
Well, it's... I can't even speak on it. Yeah, he's a unicorn.
Well, I'm excited for October 12th, Sunday, Gramercy Theater, Death Cult.
With Patriarchy. Patriarchy's going to DJ, and there could be a surprise act playing with us, TBD. So stay tuned to Lip Service, Scott Lips, for everything
cult related.
Everything Lips related.
And October 14th, Beacon. Those are two great shows in New York you can't miss.
Beacon. Get your beak to the Beacon. I know it's a Tuesday night. Who cares?
But in a way, you're kind of opening up for yourself because you're doing Death Cult and the Cult at the Beacon.
Yeah. I suppose. Well, I don't know about opening, but...
You're like playing both sets, so...
It will happen. We did it yesterday and we all looked at each other when we did the intermission part at the intermission. And after we did the Death Cult portion, we all looked at each other and went like, oh, wow. And now we're going to go play a cult set. Everyone was a little, I wouldn't say shocked, but there was definitely a sense of, this is interesting. This is really interesting. Because you get to reset. We get to reset.
Yeah.
And just taking that minute to reset, when we hit the first song in the cult set, it was on straight away. So it's like 2 gigs in one. Which we've never done anything like this. So anything can happen. It's not fully planned out. We have kind of a rough draft of what we think's going to happen. Hopefully it comes off. But we aspire to make a, that everybody leaves in a state of euphoria.
Get ready for a raw, visceral experience. Death Cult, October 12th, and The Cult,
it's gonna
October
be 14th sweaty.
In New York City. Sweaty. Visceral, sweaty, and raw. Sweaty.
Sweaty and raw. Raw dog.
I love you, my friend. Great to see you. And
you,
I'm going to be seeing you in a couple of days. All right. We'll speak soon. Thanks,
Scott,
again.
Thank you so much from us for your support. It's been incredible.
You're the best.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to this. Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
All right, see you soon.
You're listening to Spin Magazine's Lip Service.
Check out the return of Death Cult on October 12th, Gramercy Theater, New York City. Catch The Cult on tour throughout the U.S., tickets online everywhere, and go to The Cult on Instagram and online to find them playing at a city near you. Thank you, Ian, for coming by the show again. And make sure you show up at the Gramercy Theater in New York City this week and October 14th at the Beacon Theater. And to any of their U.S. shows that are coming up, see you next time.